CEO Outlook with Rita Trahan.
Welcome to CEO Outlook, a podcast about the changing roles and challenges faced by business leaders. I'm Rita Trahan. On today's podcast, some really interesting topics. Staff bonuses, if you thought they were boring, wait till you hear what my guests have to say about the topic. Business leaders and politics, they never normally mix. We're going to mix it up and talk about the impact that they have when they get together. On today's episode, I have the pleasure of being joined by Harry Kalymnios, leadership speaker at the Thought Gym, and Mark Eltringham, founder and publisher of Workplace Insight. Harry, Mark, thank you for joining me.
Pleasure.
So first up, let's talk about staff bonuses. They've been around for a long time in many, many different forms. One of UK's most respected investors has decided to scrap bonuses at his firm. Really interesting, because he's arguing that they're largely effective in boosting performance. What's most interesting is that this is a fund manager. And if you know anything about funds and the city, bonuses are what keeps most of the people alive and interested in their roles. So the move by Neil Woodford's fund management business runs counter to conventional wisdom in the city. So, Mark, what do you think? Are bonuses good? Do they really help motivate staff?
Well, I think we've understood the reality of this for a very long time. I mean, it goes back to Frederick Hertzberg's two-factor theory of what motivates and demotivates people. So what are sources of satisfaction and what are sources of dissatisfaction? So the sources of dissatisfaction are things like feeling valued for what you do, having a sense of purpose. What is a source of dissatisfaction when it doesn't meet your expectations are things like salary, you know, your holidays, your, you know, pension arrangements and stuff like that. And the two are not necessarily connected. And so what happens in practice, and there's a really good, have you ever seen any of these animations that the RSA does looking at specific issues?
No.
There's a really, really interesting one. It's only about 10 minutes long, but it encapsulates everything that you need to know about motivating people in the workplace. And what the science says is that so long as you're meeting people's salary expectations, money is not an issue. You basically take money off the table. And I guess that's what this guy is saying. But the narrative that most people buy into is the more money you give to people, the more motivated they become. And in actuality, that is not the case. So this guy is perfectly right in saying that. All the science backs him up. But it's one of those issues where what we know about the issue and what the sort of accepted narrative are often two different things completely.
So let's talk about that then, Harry. The narrative is different to what all the academic research and the rest of it would say. Neil Woodford says, you know, the academic correlation says there's no correlation between bonuses and performance. And yet, if you talk to people on the street, I'll give you an example. My own example, I was talking to the woman who was doing my hair the other day and I said, I'm doing a podcast about bonuses. What do you think? Do you think people should have bonuses? She went off on a roll. She was like, absolutely, she said, because, you know, for those of us that work, you know, just for a minimum wage, which goes to your point, Mark, it's got to be the right base salary first. Bonuses are our way of sort of compensating. But is that really true? Let's build on Mark's point. Is there more to motivating people than just money?
Yeah, I think Mark's absolutely right. And there's plenty of studies which are showing that if you're given extrinsic motivation, such as the salary bonuses, you're not going to be nearly as creative, not nearly as rewarded in your job as if you have an intrinsic motivator, something that provides you with a sense of purpose in your job. So feeling valued, absolutely, and having a sense of purpose in what the leader's doing and what the CEO's driving towards doing. And I was watching or rewatching an interesting TED talk by Dan Pink, which I'm sure many people have seen.
We all wish we were Dan Pink, right?
So, you know, and again, he talks same results. All the science is showing that for certain tasks, if it's very mechanical, then maybe these financial bonuses do play a part. But that's not really the role that a lot of people are performing these days. And it requires more creative problem-solving thinking, and those type of tasks are not actually benefited by these extrinsic rewards of throwing more cash. We know it doesn't work. Although I think what the science says and what people do is vastly different. And it's not just in the case of this with bonuses. It's in the case when it comes to food and nutrition. It's in the case we see what we want to see sometimes, and we become so caught up in our habits that it makes the news to break ranks, like this guy Neil Woodford did. So I think he's doing the right thing, as long as those staff are motivated through other rewards that are actually of value to them, because everyone has different values in life. And for someone, it might be finishing at 5 o'clock every day rather than working till 10 to get that bonus because they want to go home and spend time with their family. So by identifying what values people have as a high importance, and you work towards motivating them on those basis, I think that's going to be more beneficial.
So both of you, interestingly, are coming out on the side of, you know, bonuses don't do what they're supposed to do. So my question to both of you is, do you think companies are just lazy? Because, you know, they've been using bonuses for a long time. As you say, it becomes a habit. Are companies just becoming lazy around really trying to figure out what's motivating people and what drives them, what makes them passionate, and just falling back on a good old safe hold of bonuses and money? And if so, what's our messages to companies today around this? What
do
you
think? I'm not sure that they're being lazy as such, and I'm not sure that I could categorise all companies in the same way, but I would say that the habitual patterns that people undertake are so difficult and to change and ingrained. And for a lot of companies, they don't put so much importance on really digging deep into what really drives employee well-being. They are more concerned with the numbers. I mean, a classic example, when the downturn was happening back in 2008, I used to work at the London Stock Exchange in the IT department, and it was about cutting costs wherever, just because so you could show for that next quarter that they've made a reduction. So they would get rid of people. They even got rid of all the plants because that was costing money.
It's normally coffee and sandwiches to go,
yeah,
right?
I've seen that behaviour. Yeah. I mean, I remember an office furniture company that we were doing some work with. Mm-hmm. I mean, when the last recession hit, because, you know, people in that sort of sector are always the first to feel those sorts of things, they immediately said, OK, well, there's no free coffee anymore. And they had an exodus of people about it because it was just like, it's a tiny little thing and people just thinking, it just sends completely the wrong signal to people.
And they don't feel valued, they don't feel appreciated. And things like the plants, they clearly people don't realize, recognize that actually having plants in the office has been proven to boost creativity as well. So, you know, but they're very short-sighted on myopic in their thinking sometimes.
It can be silly things, can't it, like that? Because if they'd said a pay freeze, people would say, you know, you could make the case for that. And they would say, okay, fine.
Yeah.
You know? Whereas if you start then stripping back on things like that, they kind of get an alarm bell. It's an odd dynamic, and it's not what people think. And like you, I don't think firms are being lazy. I just think, you know, I always come back to narratives that people get convinced about, you know, and they'll sort of go along with it. And even when you present them with evidence, you know, and we've known about this for decades, that they still buy into the narrative, you know, and they'll still act on it, even though you can actually show them that, you know, so long as you take money off the table, as long as it's not an issue, you then have to focus on all the other stuff, you know, that makes people feel good about what they do.
So I like the fact that you both challenged me and says it's not about companies being lazy, it's about them really sort of connecting to different ways of thinking about how to sort of engage and motivate and create the right environments. And then when there are issues, you know, look at what you decide to cut first, because really what it's about is how are you, you know, Neil Woodford is about looking at different ways to motivate and to get people to deliver the best that they can. You know, there's also been this thing around bonuses that we've seen where it's had some really detrimental effects. You know, the short-termism of a lot of corporations where it's a quarter-by-quarter focus, bonuses that are geared around an annual plan. We've seen that blow up big star with some big companies, AIG, some of the banks, where people have walked away with millions of dollars of bonuses and have left an array of mess behind them.
Absolutely.
So, you know, with that, you know, is there a message in there around bonuses beyond that sort of motivation piece, which is clearly absolutely important? Is there a message around that it's driving behaviours that are actually detrimental, not just to the individual, but also to companies and brands at large? What do you guys think about that?
I think it depends on how it's arranged and how it's orchestrated. I know certain bonuses maybe are drip-fed over, you know, many, many years and to do with options and things like that. But I think where rewards are short-term gain, and I think, unfortunately, we live in a society where people want that quick fix. They want the things now. They want to get things now and pay for it later, as opposed to the other way around. And I think when you reward behaviour on a short-term basis like that, there's no loyalty. And I think it comes back to this idea, I think, where employees need to be bought into the higher vision of the company or the leader or whoever it might be. because that will retain those members of staff to promote that business into a leading competitor. But when you just throw money, well, then the answer's obvious. The next company that comes along that throws more money at that person, mm-hmm. it's going to then take that person. So once you can take that away, what the other company can't offer that perhaps the company that person's working for can is that culture, that sense of being, whatever it might be, the intangible stuff. And it won't matter how much money he's thrown mm-hmm. at that person from another company, you'll still retain your best talent. At least that's my view, I don't know.
Well, I think, again, you know, to come back to Hertzberg, you know, you kind of see this all the time, you know, that what motivates people are abstract or nominally abstract things like a sense of meaning, a sense of being valued within the organisation, you know, and all of these sorts of things. But they're hard things to achieve, you know. Because I also think that one of the issues with bonuses, and sort of pay generally, is if you link it to objectives, you've got to make sure you've got the objectives right.
And absolutely.
And, you know, you see repeatedly that firms will set the wrong objectives. And people, if their pay is dependent on it, they'll work towards those objectives, whether it's the right thing to do for the business or not.
That's a really interesting point, you know, about sort of alignment and ensuring that actually it's really focused in the right areas. I mean, can you think of examples where you've seen that go awry around, you know, people working really, really hard, you know, but actually working really, really hard in the wrong direction and or not challenging stuff when actually may not be the right thing given the time horizon?
Well, I mean, one of the areas that you do see is the public sector is pretty bad at doing this. I mean, not necessarily related to bonuses, but, you know, if you say challenge a hospital to reduce its waiting times or to cut the time it takes to do operations and stuff like this, you know, they will, you know, if they've got no other way of doing it with resources or management or whatever, they'll start to find other ways to make it look as though, you know, exactly. they're meeting their objectives.
There's always a workaround.
You know, and I think it's easy to be cynical about that, mm-hmm. but, you know, when you say to somebody, you know, your job's on the line if you don't meet these objectives, you know. Because the other thing you see as well is that, you know, in the commercial world, you know, you see, you know, firms, they will challenge salespeople to meet certain targets mm-hmm. and bonuses, yeah. you know. And they will engage in certain behaviours to meet those bonuses.
Yeah. Customer service people, you know, you've got to resolve the call first time or you've got to spend less time on the phone with each customer, whereas you have companies such as Zappos, like the shoe company mm-hmm. that was bought by Amazon, who empowered their customer service people to spend long time talking to their customers to build that relationship and gave them the autonomy to give them a certain amount of money per customer if they needed like refunds, so they didn't have to keep going to management or anyone else. And they famously offer money to people to leave Zappos after 3 months if it's not the right thing for them to do, of which, you know, 97% of people, I think it is, remain with them and don't take that $3,000 bonus or whatever else they're given. So, I mean, they've obviously doing something right.
Yeah, that's a really interesting insight.
The guy who runs Zappos, I've forgotten his name.
Tony Hite.
Yeah, he's a real visionary, you know. If you look in every aspect of how they function, you know, he's really sort of focused on the right things, I think. So.
And he's an interesting guy because he's, you know, he's a real, I think, self-learner. You know, he was quoted about a year or so ago, I think, about how much money he'd lost. I think it was like $1 billion or so on bad recruitment decisions that he had made at his executive level. And he said, you know, I lost all this money, but I really learnt from it. I really learnt about the type of people that are really successful. So this visionary of, like, the kind of people that I need in this company may not be the people that look great on the resume when they come in. And, you know, mea culpa for not making some of the decisions that I needed to make soon enough. So, yeah, I find him a very interesting individual of what he's trying to do. And
yeah,
you know, the whole idea of spend time with the customers where it matters. I recently was with a company that's working with a customer service team and they're tearing their hair out because they're saying, you know, we're measured by these net promoter scores and by how many calls we make, but actually we're not really solving what the customer wants because we've only got a certain amount of time to solve the call. And then they have to ring back because they've got more than one thing that they want to talk about. And so this idea that what that sort of said to me and what you talked about and Mark, what you've talked about is that bonuses will drive some results. They won't drive necessarily intrinsic value feeling and passion around the job. There's more to that that needs to be connected in the workplace, whether that's giving people autonomy, whether it's responsibility, whether it's freedom in terms of working hours, etc. So what advice would you give to companies? Like, you know, Neil's gone out and done this. He's hoping it's going to be successful. He's said, look, I'm going to put it into salary and to benefits. He hasn't said what those benefits are, but I would hope that they are some of the things that we've been talking about today. But if you were to give some advice to organisations out there today around bonuses and step back and look and say, is there something different? What would you say to them about a couple of tips that you would give them about things to do?
I guess I would find out really what their employees value. And I would also be focused on giving their employees a higher objective to strive towards, some vision, something that can collectively bring them together that is going to make them want to stay regardless, like, of bonuses or anything else. So really understanding their employees, so what their values are, and then creating a vision for the company that people can get bought into, having inspiring leaders, inspiring managers who, you know, will retain those people, because most people leave managers rather than companies. So everyone needs to be bought in from the ground up. That would be my advice. I can't give one piece of blanket advice, but that's kind of general enough that I think most companies could take something from.
Great. Mark?
Well, I would go along with that, but the first thing I would do before you do that is make sure that money is not an issue.
Yeah.
So that,
yeah, sure.
it just is not an issue for anybody. And so once you've dealt with that, then you can deal with the really important things that do actually motivate people, because money's not a motivator for most people, you know. It's, you know, mm-hmm. or at least it's only a motivator when they haven't got enough of it.
Yeah.
And as soon as you get take that issue away, then you can focus on the important stuff.
Number, yeah. It makes no difference. I think it's like $70,000 when they did the study in America, where it didn't drive happiness levels any higher. So as long as people have the basic needs, which, depending on what city in the world you live, that you can, you know, you can afford your house payments, your car payments, you can go on a holiday or two, you know, all of that, then everything on top of that, it's not as relevant.
Well, I'm really interested to see what happens with Neil Woodford's firm. I think it's going to send a shock to the stock market and the city and other firms to say, look out, particularly when you think about the millennial generation who are really interested in purpose and value. And, you know, it may not be the money at the end of the day that switches them on. So I think some of your insights and tips are really helpful. So thanks for that. Let's move on, because, you know, bonuses are an interesting topic, but politics and business leaders, this is a discussion we should be having at a dinner party with a large glass of red wine in front of us.
I would always shut that conversation down as soon as it starts.
We're not going to do that today.
As soon as anybody says politics or religion, you know, it's the old rule, just drop it.
Well, let's not do that today. Okay. Let's have some fun with this, because we're seeing, you know, really interestingly in the news, two very high-profile figures, Sir Richard Branson, Jeremy Corbyn, engaging in a Twitter war, no less, and large-scale media coverage around an issues where Jeremy Corbyn says trains should be nationalised. I mean, it's a pitch to say we should be nationalising trains. Richard Branson saying, hey, look at this picture, there were loads of empty seats, why didn't you sit together? Jeremy says, I want to sit with my wife. The debate goes on. And really, you are seeing an engagement that's beyond just two people having a difference of opinion. This is really about business leaders having a say on politics in the country around what should be private, what should be nationalised, you know, how are leaders living up to their commitments on both sides. So what do you think? Should CEOs and business leaders just stay well clear, because it's once you get in there, it's like sinking mud and it's hard to get out of? Or should they start to engage, and if so, how?
Well, I think they've already been engaging for a long time. I mean, US elections are based on business leaders paying lobbyists and contributing to campaign funds, and it's not hugely different here. I think in this case, I think it was less about politics and it's more about Richard Branson protecting his brand and his companies. And he's, you know, been the figurehead for Virgin, and one of his earliest bits of mentoring advice was to make sure that there was a person behind the brand. And I think Virgin was one of those first brands that really had a public figure. I think other companies would find it difficult to do this so much, because most people wouldn't be able to name the CEO of other companies, and it wouldn't make headlines. I think anyone in a position of authority, responsibility, has people that look up to them, can have an obligation, does have the right to have a voice, whether it's in politics or anywhere else, and use that voice to influence people who care to be influenced. So I don't see a problem with necessarily CEOs and business leaders getting into politics, in as much as everyone has a right to kind of voice their opinion. It just happens to be that they have a bigger tribe or a bigger audience than maybe you or I. I think as long as they use that wisely, I don't see a problem.
And was this appropriate, Mark, to engage in a war of words around whether there are enough seats on the Virgin train?
Well, I kind of feel like both sides have been poorly advised in what they're doing. I mean, there is a general point, which is that, you know, I don't think there's a problem. As long as they're constructive, the CEOs get involved in political issues. And so long as it comes across in the right way, you know, it's got to be presented in the right way. I think in this case, I think, there's so much stuff flying back and to, you know, I kind of feel like Jeremy Corbyn has been poorly advised in terms of trying to create a narrative from his experiences that are related to his desire to nationalise the railways. So that could have been presented differently, or not at all, preferably. I mean, I kind of see this a lot on social media as well. You know, if you start arguing with people, you know, you can both go into a downward spiral. And yeah. I kind of feel like this story has kind of followed that arc. It's like a sort of, you know, a flame war, you know, that they've got themselves involved in. And I think Branson hasn't really been clear about whether his objection is to the portrayal of you know, his trains as being crammed. And I travel on the West Coast Main Line most weeks, and I can tell you, I have had that experience of being in corridors and stuff. You know, it does happen.
Yeah.
But then that's an argument for more infrastructure spending on whatever it might be, or rolling stock or whatever. So there's a separate issue there. His problem is that it can come across that his issue is with the Labour Party's policies, or Corbyn's policies on rail nationalisation, and that's when he might get himself unstuck. You know, I think he's... Well, I don't know. Is he good at PR? In many ways, right?
Branson?
Yeah.
Well, yeah.
In many ways, you know. Mm-hmm. And this might be a misstep. I think that both of their problems are that, you know, it is like trying to argue with somebody on Twitter, you know.
You just shouldn't do
You just need to stop at some point. And, you know, and I kind of feel like it's gone on too long, and they're not doing themselves any favours on both sides now. So.
Is there some advice then for business leaders and politicians on how they engage in social media? Because social media is becoming the norm for how, you know, people communicate, pick up snippets of information. Yeah. It's only of the snippets, so you never get the full story. We've seen it in the States in the recent election between Hillary and Trump, you know, and the other leaders that have engaged in this war of words. We're seeing it now here. Is there something beyond it, the message not being so much about how do leaders and politicians engage, but how do they think about their social media strategy? What do you think, guys?
I think... when you approach social media, you have to approach it like you are live in a room with a person. It, just like you wouldn't necessarily go up to 1,500 people in a room and just keep pushing your product onto them without engaging in a conversation first, at least, and seeing if they're at least interested. You shouldn't do the same thing on social media. You shouldn't then, say, get into an argument with someone at a party and then suddenly take to the stage with microphones to have that argument in front of 1,500 people, which is what it really is on social media. So I think this is my philosophy on it anyway, and someone mentioned it to me, is if you just engage with social media like it is that, so you are having two-way dialogues, you are as if you are in a room with that person, then you have a different approach to what you're going to do, I believe. I think a lot of people think, oh, I'm behind my computer screen, I can say what I want. Getting into an argument on Twitter or anywhere else, it's just not worth it. If I get any kind of comments on any of my threads, bearing in mind you're going to get both positive and negative anyway, but if there's some further discussion to have, then I say, okay, well, let's meet for a coffee and talk this out, or let's have a chat about this, because a comment here on one thread and then another, it's just not going to work, and you're never going to come across right. We've all sent emails and text messages which have come across in a way that we didn't intend. So
that's really good. That's really good advice. The amount I can count. And see the images in my head of emails that I've sent that people have misinterpreted the tone or, the comment.
Cap locks on and couldn't be bothered to retype it, and then you sent it or whatever it might be.
And somebody leaves with a very different interpretation of what you had intended.
Yeah.
Mark, what's your comments on this?
Well, I have to agree. I mean, I've always sort of had the rule. I mean, you say a room, I'd say a pub, you know. If you were in a pub having a drink with this person, would you talk to them like that? And if the answer's no, then don't do it on social media. You know, it's as simple as that. I mean, some of the stuff... I mean, if you want to sort of lose the will to live, you know, you read the comments under a YouTube video, you know, it's just, you know, it's true. I mean, it just... And what tends to happen is the people who are the most unpleasant or the most loud or the most persistent tend to take things over, which is why things degenerate. And I think for companies on social media, you know, if somebody gets into a conversation with them, let's say, you know, they've got to know at which point they've, you know, that's it now, no more, because we're going to come across badly as well, you know.
Yeah.
So, you know, let them rant and rave and whatever and say these things, but you know, you just let them go.
Yeah, so high profile figures like Richard Branson in this instance, and Harry, you know, you sort of said it early on about, you know, everybody knows Richard Branson, but not everybody would know every CEO. So he stands out because, you know, he's very high profile. He's known for a number of different things, for his entrepreneurship and all the other things that he does. It feels to me that there is a role for business leaders to be helping shape the economy and helping, you know, whether you call it political or not, but having a voice in the future of the country. So given that voice, and if you are as powerful as Richard Branson, how could we take what he's done, which we're kind of saying, like, you know what, maybe you should have done it differently. How could we advise people like Richard to be using their voice in much more powerful ways if they really want to engage in bringing business leaders and politicians together? Because I think that's a real opportunity to be had. So what can we do to get these CEOs that have this great brand to engage much more in much more positive and effective ways than what makes a good, I would say, tabloid read today around what's happening around there?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think to be fair to Sir Richard Branson, actually, he does a really good job with engaging in bringing together leaders of the world. I think the whole elders movement that he had, that he's created from Necker Island, where bringing together people like President Jimmy Carter and Nelson Mandela when he was around, and Reverend Desmond Tutu, and bringing together leaders. Now, are these current political leaders? A lot of them, I think the rule is that they can't be a current political leader, because I think there's so many other factors that go into how a political leader runs their party or their country, which we don't maybe know about. So I think, to be fair to him, he is using his celebrity and his reach to kind of bring leaders together. I think this has been one of those newspaper tabloidy type things to make a story with a couple of names that they like to put in the press, really, if I'm honest. I'm not a big reader of popular news media, I must admit, for the reason that it doesn't generally serve me a positive purpose. So this story I did see, obviously, I think he's doing a good job. I think, like, you know, people like Jamie Oliver who's challenged certain leaders as well on what they're doing. I know he was quite vocal the other day.
A lot about them, the food.
Yeah. Theresa May, yeah. And he said something about the other day. And I think you've got to have people like that who are respected somewhat, potentially, arguably, more than the politicians, and also stick around longer than the politicians, to use that influence to bring people into the conversation should they wish to get into that conversation.
Well, I would agree with that. I think politicians engaging with popular business people, you know, is something that politicians welcome. I mean, there are obviously some unpopular business people that might want to engage with the politicians that the politicians shouldn't go near, because, you know, reputations rub off, you know. Jamie Oliver, you know, is popular, you know, and he's a good person to engage with. You know, there are others, perhaps, that they wouldn't want to be engaged with, but, you know, that would just be my take.
Yeah. So politicians and business leaders, think very carefully about your roles, because you do have a very, what I'm hearing you guys say is, you have a very influential role to play in society today. Use your power and your influence wisely and pick your sweet spots.
Well, I think politicians should worry more about their own reputations than those of the business leaders.
Tell me more.
We said we weren't going to do politics.
Oh, come on. It's only fun if we get into some of the stuff people want to hear about.
Speaking objectively, politicians have a real problem with their image, you know.
Totally agree.
And, you know, I think for all, you know, when you look at things like Brexit, you have to say that is bound up with their inability to control the way people perceive them. And you look over the Atlantic in America at the moment as well, you have the same issue, you know. The thing has turned into an absolute circus. The only reason why Trump has any hope of becoming president is because people are so fed up with politicians, you know. And you just think they are now paying the price for what they've done over a period of years, you know. And people are cynical about it. And, you know, I keep on hearing, you know, people talking about politicians saying, oh, you know, the vast majority are in it for the right reasons. You know, they want to do good. You know, they want to do this and that. You think, yeah, but they're not the ones that matter.
Yeah, they're not the ones at the top of the tree. And I guess that's the thing, you know. And I think generally I've got an inherent belief that everyone is good or tries to do the best they can. I think sometimes when you get to certain levels of power, certainly within the political parties, I don't feel as though they have as much power as we think they do. And I think there are so many other influences that occur. I mean, we say the president of the United States is the most powerful man in the world. I doubt that, to be honest. There are a lot of people behind the scenes that probably have more power. And they just happen to be the figurehead and the person that people put attention to for 4 years or 8 years. And the same with politics in the UK. You know, it's a short amount of time. So I'm not sure where I was going with that point. But
I think you're right. Right, and actually what you both touched on again is, like, it's a narrative issue in some cases, right? Mm. It's the narrative that people hear and the narrative that people are taking away. So this, that they are, you know, fed up with mainstream politics, but believe it. Like, they believe that the president of the United States is the most powerful man in the world. And I guess what you're saying is there's a lot behind it, but we're not actually helping people to really look at the true narrative around what can be possible versus what we feel is possible today.
I kind of feel like a lot of the way that the world is shaped is based on a series of sort of apex fallacies. So you see what happens at the top and you think, okay, well, you know, that's how it is. And actually, it's not. You know, if you talk about business leaders, you know, people will say Alan Sugar, you know, and Richard Branson and Bill Gates and whoever, you know, Warren Buffett and all these sorts of people. And actually, most people work in small businesses. You know, it's what, you know, I can't remember what the stats are in the UK, but, you know, the vast majority of people work for small businesses. You know, it's 98% of businesses are under 10 people, whatever it might be. Some, you know, and you think, well, you know, that is the true nature of the business world. You know, it's not the City of London, although that's important. There's this whole other stuff that's going on. And I think it's the same with politicians. You know, you have local councillors, you have the civil service, you know, you have the sort of grassroots, you know, you have all sorts of people involved in it. But everything is focused on the people at the top. And we kind of, you know, it distorts our vision of things. What's the name of the head of civil service? Is it Jeremy Hayward in the UK? Because I kind of think he sees himself as like the true, you know, leader of the country. And actually, I think there's probably a lot of truth in that as well. He's the one who runs it on a day-to-day basis. It's not the Prime Minister or whoever, you know. Yeah. So, and I think we need to keep an eye out for the apex fallacies. I mean, I see it in, you know, what we do.
So describe for listeners what apex fallacies are, because some people might not know what that is and be interested to know that. Well, so share a little bit about
I can give you an example from our own sphere. I mean, we write about sort of workplace design and management. And when you read the media and look at presentations and stuff, when they look at trends in sort of workplace design, it focuses on really exciting, cool workplaces. You know, Google's a classic example. You know, when you look at what they're doing on their campuses in the US, you know, amazing buildings designed by world-class architects, you know, astonishing stuff. And so that sort of goes across the piece because that's what, you know, is presented. When you actually look at where most people work, they work in pretty mundane surroundings, you know. And so the perception that you can get is that, you know, if you haven't got this amazingly cool workplace, you know, you're kind of lagging behind. Whereas in reality, you know, most people work in fairly decent surroundings. And I think there's a lot of that kind of goes on in the world. You know, you look at the top and think that's how things are. Mm. And actually, it's not. There's a whole layer below that that's a much bigger than the top. And so you've got to be careful that your vision isn't distorted by looking only at the apex.
You need to peel back that onion a little bit more to see what's, you know, each layer has a different level to it.
It's hard though, isn't it? Because you can only judge on what you're presented, you know, and, you know, it's...
Therein lies the problem with the media which is why I don't tend to look at it, because you shape your reality based on what a certain editor, newspaper owner, or whoever it might be, decides to tell you, rather than getting out and really exploring the news and things that are of value to you. If you only read the newspaper, you'd think that the world is an absolute terrible place, and in fact it's not. You know, this is like the smallest percentage of things that are going on that happen to be highlighted because they sell and they sensationalise things. So it's looking at a bit like what we're talking about here, the apex, but you're looking at one small thing and you're drawing an entire conclusion about the whole from it.
Yeah.
Which I think is dangerous.
Did you see that survey that was out in the past week about teenage depression levels? So it's hugely high in the UK. It's partly it's related to social media use, and that's this sort of relentless flow of information and people getting hooked on their screens and not taking time out. And everybody's got to do that. But it's also related to, as you were saying, this sort of barrage of images and information. So you know you can easily get downbeat about the fact that you think, say, terrorism is a bigger problem than it used to be, or murder levels, or, you know, just awful things. But it's 24-hour rolling news now, and it didn't used to be. I mean, I'm starting to rant now. It sounds like I am in the pub. I talked to my sons about the days when television didn't... There was no breakfast television. It came on at lunchtime for a couple of hours, went off, came back on in the evening, finished at 11 o'clock, and that was it, you know? And you'd have a newspaper. And if you wanted to find something out, you went to a library, you know. And I sound like an old fart when I'm saying this, but you think, in many ways, that's you're forced to take time away from information, you know. I don't think that's the case now, and it presents you with this stuff. And I kind of feel like, you know, the younger generation kind of have this relentless pressure on them to sort of meet, well, not just get the depressing news, but meet a load of expectations about how they should look, what they should be doing, what they should be wearing. You know, and it can't be good for them. I do sound like an old fart, don't I? So, you know, but
the good news is they can tune in to podcasts like this where they get to hear people giving real life perspectives and views.
You have a choice of what you want to listen to, and that's what I do. I'm an avid fan of podcasts. I don't listen to any radio, really. It's just podcasts and other audio programs. And that's the thing with when it comes to news now is that it's not about getting no news in so much. It's being about selective about what kind of news you want in. And if you're like, I talk a lot about how powerful the subconscious mind is with the work I do. And one example I give is, would you want like a stranger to come into your house to speak to your 5-year-old or 6-year-old and tell them all the evils in the world and about gun crime and knife crime on their street and then walk out again? And you probably wouldn't want to do that. And I say that your unconscious mind is taking that information in, and yet the thing that most people do before they go to bed is watch the news for the 15th time that day. And the first thing they do with the radio alarm going off is like 7 a.m. or whatever it is, and then the news comes on, and it's a constant barrage. And I say, if you do need to get the news because you feel like you need to be informed, I say do it in the middle of the day. And I would say do it with the written word more so than the visual stuff, to be honest, because of how it can be kind of articulated in the news. But not at the beginning of the day, not at the end of the day, when you're like really susceptible to what goes into your mind on an unconscious level. So,
Harry, you've converted me. I'm like already beginning to think about changing when and how I watch the news. So some really valuable insights
and
around that.
The things that you're actually important to you, rather than, you know, don't pick up the metro necessarily because it's generally nothing of their value to you. But if you're looking at HR news, then you've got your feed about HR. You know, you've got your feed about CEOs, whatever it might be, maybe sports, a particular sport. And then you have that at the time that you want to absorb it rather than constantly.
Well, I think that's true. And, you know, we're kind of a bit off topic, but, you know, I kind of feel like people are very bad at managing information. You know, and it's all new to us, you know, I think, you know, for everybody. And they've got to find better ways of doing it. It's why companies, I think, are getting more interested in mindfulness and so on. It's like just encouraging people to switch off.
Yeah.
And, of course, Arianna Huffington has just written that book
that's
and has
right.
sort of dedicated herself to to looking at wellness issues.
She's really on my page, and I've written for Huffington Post a couple of times. I've had a few communications with her, and what's quite interesting with her, actually, I found, which is quite unusual, is that she is all about turning off and that, but I get emails back from her within 3 or 4 hours, which is faster than people.
She switches off. I actually met her in person, and she does. She said she tells all of her employees to switch their emails off at 6 p.m. If she gets an email at 6 p.m, she will not respond to it. And this is because of her own personal health, where she actually had an incident which caused her to write her book. She's a fabulous woman. She's very entertaining.
But there are companies who are now making it a disciplinary issue. In Germany in particular, I think. I think BMW have done it. But but you know, well, so don't quote me. And it is, if you respond to an email after 6 o'clock, that then becomes a disciplinary issue. They're not going to fire you, but they're trying to encourage a different way to tell you to
yeah.
to stop.
And I think it.
It
needs to come from the top down with those things, because people won't do it if they then see that their boss is kind of looking at emails or.
But if it goes across the whole company, I think that's good. And there's also this sort of issue of blue screens as well. You know, the blue light that's in screens, you know, it disrupts people's sleep and so on. So there's a whole level of management of people's time and information that, you know, needs to change.
I'm always banging on about sleep. I've done so much around sleep myself in the last few years, and of which, blue light is one of those things. So you can have things on your phone, such as Twilight. I know that Apple's latest phone has got night shift or whatever it is to take that blue light away, and having those lights down low at night, because it will affect your sleep. It will raise your cortisol levels. It reduces your melatonin levels, which will prevent you from getting to sleep. So there's just a whole plethora of issues with the technology now that you have to manage it carefully.
So guys, we've had like an amazing conversation which started off talking about staff bonuses, really talked about actually it's more than money that motivates people. There's a lot of things that go into that, to the role that politicians and business leaders play, to really talking about the essence of some really important issues around sort of health, wellness, that all kind of link together in some way. Because when you're seeing, you know, we talked about big name brands, Adriana Huffington, she's a massive brand, and she's going out there and promoting the need to really think about how you work, when you work, the wellness in work. Sadly, we could continue this conversation, I think, for at least another 3 hours, and we'd have a whole range of topics to cover. But I think that's all we've got time for today. So, Harry, Mark, how can people find out more about you? Do you have personal websites? Are you on Twitter? I know. I'm sure you use it wisely. So, Harry, how can people get in contact with you?
Yeah, the best way, I'm on all the social media outlets, whether it's Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, as The Thought Gym. So thought as in thinking. And I also have a website, thethoughtgym.com, which they can go to. Alternatively, if they look at my name, harrykalymnios.com is another website.
Okay, my website is workplaceinsight.net. I'm on Twitter as Insight on Work, which is when I get my professional head on. And Mark Eltrow as me, the human being. And we've obviously got a LinkedIn group, and we're on Google and Facebook, the usual things. So.
Great. Thanks, guys. Well, you can find out about me on Twitter at Rita_Trahan, and you can also read more about me on my website, ritatrahan.com. Also, please watch out for my book, Unleashing Capacity, The Hidden Human Resources, which will be available to buy on Amazon. And you can also find out more importantly about this podcast, because it's a way to find out real news, as Harry said, and you can subscribe to the show at ceo-outlook.com. Harry, Mark, thanks so much for joining me today. And listeners, thanks for listening.